Coming up, what an excellent day for the power of Christ. Well, howdy folks, and welcome to Minute 111 of The Exorcist Minute, a show where we endeavor to examine, extrapolate, and excavate The Exorcist, minute by terrifying minute. My name is Lester Ryan Clark.
And I'm Keenan Diaz.
And we'll be your holy guides on this journey through what some have called the scariest movie of all time. Okay, so our minute begins with our exorcists getting up from the floor, having just been knocked off their feet by an earthquake.
And it ends with them saying, "The power of Christ compels you."
Yes, folks, I don't think there's any question about our opening today. We got one of the most famous, if not the most famous line in the film here. What do we think, Keenan? Is this the line? Are there any others?
I guess it is, right? I guess this one is. You know it's The Exorcist for some reason, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. If we had to rank them, I would say number one is this. Number two is What an Excellent Day for an Exorcism.
Uh-huh.
Then we got Your Mother Sucks Cocks in Hell.
That's my number one, but I understand where you're coming from. Yes.
Yeah. It's always very popular, but maybe not one you can whip out in parties. well, certain parties. So these are like the top tier lines in terms of recognition. You can say these lines with little or no context, and someone would know that you're referring to The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got the middle tier lines. Again, not in terms of like how good they are. They're all great, but these ones you might have to be a little more familiar with the movie. We got keep away, the sow is mine, and do you know what she did, right? And your mother is in here with us.
Oh, wait a second. Do you know what she did? Your cunting daughter.
Right. Oh, excuse me.
And your mother is in here with us, you cunting son.
Oh, yes, yes. That's in the version, the extended version you've never seen.
That's right.
In yes, 4K.
Yes. Yeah, but do you know what she did? Your cunting daughter. Yes, yes,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Oh, yeah. And of course, why you do this to me, Dimmy? Right.
We said this, I think, at the beginning, but that was one that when we were in college, we would say to each other all the time.
Yeah.
To you and I, to like, I don't know, I guess make each other sad. Like, it was like sad chicken.
Yeah.
We're just chickening each other. Like. Because it just is too sad. I think the only way we can get over how sad it was to make it a game between the
yeah.
two of us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're doing this show today. we gotta exercise our own demons.
That's right.
Yeah. And then, okay, also just saying Marin's name in a demonic voice. It's like, Marin.
Oh, right.
Right? Right? We get that because, like, who the hell is named Marin, right? Mm-hmm. Other than the character in this movie. But I think nowadays, not so much. One of my students actually said, oh, I thought Marin was the girl's name. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, yeah, if you've never seen this movie, it does kind of sound like a girl's name. It's like a mix between Karen and Mary, right?
Right.
So today, I think it goes in the middle tier, although I would still put it up in the top tier.
Right. You say Karen and Mary, but Sharon and Mary, come on.
Sharon,
Sharon
yeah.
Here, yeah, yeah. I would include in this middle tier of you know, for stands, for fans, right? You're going to die up there. I like
that
one.
Oh, yes, 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 absolutely, right? I how could I forget that?
Yeah, and that's specific, right? Like these ones, you know it's from The Exorcist.
Uh-huh.
They couldn't say that in Alien. They couldn't say that in Rosemary's Baby.
No.
Because no. He's going to the moon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Bam, pow.
That was take one. It's like, oh, it looks like we have a guest. And they all just turn and Reagan's just like, one of these days, Alice.
One of these days, Alice. Bam, pow. I don't know how to explain that to young students of mine who they're like, oh, everything's racist and everything. Like, yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, yeah, but this joke is about beating his wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why is that funny? Like, and then you're not supposed to say, I don't know, it is funny. You're supposed to say, oh, I don't know, it's just very unfunny.
Yeah. If you look at human history and the timeline of when we started valuing human life, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like there's, you go far back enough and we have like Punch and Judy, which is like grotesque now, right? Like we can't.
Yeah.
And if folks, if you don't know what Punch and Judy is, you know, go check that out. Joke's on you.
You have to be wandering through a park.
You'd have to jump into a time machine and go back to the.
Yeah, go to a park in the 1910s, and there's a little booth, and there's Punch and Judy in there, kicking the shit out of each other, and all the kids in the audience are like, "This is why we go to the park."
Yeah, but it's it's mostly Punch.
Yes.
Though it's like Punch always wins. Punch is the husband, and he what does he do? The traditional show is like he beats his wife, kills her, bamboozles the policeman who comes to get him. Somehow he dies, goes to hell, beats the devil to death. And then the whole premise of that thing is isn't Mr. Punch a card? He's beating the shit out of everybody, and he's not getting any repercussions for it.
Right, and all the kids looking up at it in the park, eating their sugared popcorn.
Sugar popcorn.
Oy, when I grow up, I hope I could be like Punch. I am.
How did we get here? How did we get to Punch and Judy?
the Honeymooners.
Oh, the Honeymooners, right. It's just a hop, skip, and a punch in the face from Punch and Judy to the Honeymooners.
Get to the moon.
Yep, there you go. All right. But yeah, yes, definitely you're going to die up there. Is that swap those out, right? So we have Reagan saying one of these days, right to the moon. And then we have, what the hell's his name?
Ralph Cramden.
And then we have Ralph Cramden. He's like,
you're going to die up there.
I'm not laughing. That's horrible.
Horrible.
That's absolutely terrible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the middle tier, the very problematic middle tier. and then we have the bottom tier, or let's say the deepest tier, which doesn't make any sense. But these are lines that specifically Exorcist fans know. This would be like, you know, Mirabile dictu, right? Or Le Plume de Matante, right? If I say Le Plume de Matante to someone, and they don't think I'm just speaking French to them, right? Or if I say Quod nomen mihi est, and they answer with Le Plume de Matante, and then laugh maniacally, then, you know, we're on the same page.
Well, then you should marry that person.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's how you know it's the one.
Yeah. I might put, do you like movies, Father? Which isn't what he says, actually. Hold on.
Right. It's that Luke, I am your father, you know, type thing.
He says, I get passes. Right. So I say here, hey, Father, you like movies? Well, I get passes to the best shows.
Okay.
So it's not, you like movies, Father?
Yes. Okay. Now I see. Yeah. It's so you can make it bite-sized, right? Because like if you just say, no, I am your father, it's like, where, what does that mean?
Who
movie
is this?
Are you? Yeah, right?
Who breathes like that?
Yeah. So you have to like adapt it just a little bit, and he's like, Luke, I am your father, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then we got the sub tier. These are lines that only the true blue exorcist connoisseurs know. These are the deep cuts, folks. Stuff like, please call me Chris. All right.
Yeah.
And then when Chris first meets Damien on the bridge, and she says, Father Karras, have you ever had a dream that you could do anything? And of course, who can forget Carl's most famous line? This marks you as an exorcist expert, I think.
Right, and you have to know the most famous line from the most famous character who doesn't exist, which is the horseman.
Right. Sharon's talking on the phone, and she's like, "What do you want to do tonight? Do you want to go see a movie?" And then just on the other end of the phone, you just hear. But no, folks, this is the famous line. This is why we do the sign out like that. Mm-hmm. And that's not meant to be like condescending. A fellow teacher started listening to our show and she had never seen the movie. And eventually she listened to enough of our episodes. She was like, okay, I gotta watch this thing. And it got to What an Excellent Day for an Exorcism. And she was like, oh, and then it got to this part where it's like the power of Christ compels you. And she was like, oh, those guys are pretty clever.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. I hope she understands that the Sally Field lines aren't from our movie.
What Sally Field lines? What are you talking about?
Oh, you know, the sow. You really like me. And, you know, yeah, the other Sally Field lines. There's all sorts of Sally Field lines throughout our show. Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about. I can't think of a single time we've quoted Sally Field.
Yeah.
In any of her movies on this show.
Now, in 3024, in the dystopian future where the liberal global government has banned the word Christ from movies. you watch The Exorcist, but you can't say that. Ours will be the only, you know, the only like intact version. We're saying the power of Christ. Yeah, yeah. Because they won't have gotten to podcasts yet. They're just gonna censor the movies, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then people will be listening to this podcast about a movie that no longer has the word Christ in it.
That's right.
Right.
They're gonna think we made up this character Christ. Uh-huh. That he's like the horseman.
It's like, you know what? I really, really like this Exorcist minute, but it's like there's like all these, like, there's the horseman, there's Truly, and there's this Christ guy.
Yeah, the Christ guy.
That have nothing to do with the actual film. What's it going to be in 3024? Is like the power of all holy beings. Is it going to be like hashtag not my Chris's line?
Oh, like all religions or whatever?
In Believer?
No, well, I don't know. I was thinking it'd be all like the power of one click shopping, you know?
Oh, there we go.
That's the future I imagine.
Yeah. The power of Michael Mouse compels you. But yeah, folks, let's get back to the top of this minute and see what is going on here. Remember, the room had just been hit with this massive jolt, causing it to shake and knock our two exorcists off their feet. So this minute opens on that same shot, and they are both getting back up. What a great thing to start on thematically. We talked about how weird it feels breaking this final battle up into minutes, but I like how the last one ended with them falling. And here we see them getting back up. Mm-hmm. And right off the bat, I wanted to see, okay, who gets back up first? And folks, I had to rewind and rewatch this thing at least 5 times to see what's going on here. Partly because Dimmy is wrapped up inside those thick black shadows on the right. But he falls first. He goes down really fast, just like swallowed up by those shadows. He completely disappears. Marin falls back against the wall and he starts to sink down. And then he like pushes from the wall back to the bed and is like in the process of getting back up before we cut. So he takes longer to fall and longer to rise. And in the middle of his getting back up, Dimmy's hand like shoots out of the darkness to grab the bed post and pull himself back up. And he's almost immediately back up where he started. So he fell faster, fell deeper because he completely disappeared. And then he was able to get back up quicker. And yet he still had to catch up with Marin because he started getting back up a little bit later. Again, it's just a perfect visual of where they are both physically and spiritually.
Mm. I think I've lost my footing, Tom.
Uh, you're the best we've got. But it's not just my shoes, Tom. It's these slippery floors. I can't handle it. I'm unfit. I need out. Yeah. But yeah, like comparing them both, right? Like mm-hmm. Dimmy is hale and hearty, so he can get back up quicker, but right. he also stays down a little bit longer. But the great thing about this is the timing of both of them makes it so that they get back up almost at the exact same time, right? Mm-hmm. Regardless of like how much or how deep or how fast they fell, which I really like. And Merrin never stops speaking. Even when he's getting back up, he's calling upon God to look down in pity. And he's not asking God to look down in pity on them, having just fallen. Even as he's rising from a fall, he's asking God to look down in pity on Regan Teresa McNeil. Mm-hmm. But before he even finishes that sentence, before he even says the name, Howdy is interrupting again. Right after look down in pity, Howdy turns to Dimmy and shouts, "You killed your mother." As he's shouting and as Merrin is still praying, we cut and we are now on a close-up of Howdy. Though thankfully he is not looking at us. Regan's eyes are fixed on Dimmy and her breath is coming out in sulfuric clouds as this dragon continues saying, "You left her alone to die." Again, slightly different from how this scene plays out in the book, not just how it's shorter, but also the feeling behind the words. Howdy is relishing this moment in the book. He's got everybody on a string and he's making them all dance one by one. Mm-hmm. But again, here, it's just the priests. And we're a little less sure who has the upper hand here, especially after that earthquake from the last minute. And here, Howdy seems either desperate or, and this might just be me projecting book Howdy again, genuinely angry that this guy who left his mother alone to die is pretending to be a priest in this ritual. Like, mm-hmm. like you're not even worthy enough to cast me out. What are you even doing here? Mm-hmm. But no, as we continue to cover this battle in the film, I don't think movie Howdy has that luxury to be offended. I think he is desperate. I think this this fight is quick and nasty. The book fight is like a sword fight in the movies. It's like two guys swashbuckling through an old castle, Princess Bride style, and using the environment in like clever ways. Mm-hmm. Like when they're in the banquet hall, they hop up onto the long table and they're fencing down the length of it and exchanging like witty banter. It's like, "Ah, well, what you never realized, old boy, is that you killed your mother and left her alone to die. How do you like them apples?" And here he would throw an apple.
Right.
And Karis would catch it with his sword and he would take a bite and he'd be like, "No, I don't much care for it." And then they'd continue fighting, right? That's the type of sword fight where like they pass a chessboard and one of them reaches out and like moves a piece and then they continue fighting, right?
Yeah, and there's a bunch of pulleys installed in this castle that do nothing except cause trouble during sword fights.
Yeah, exactly.
They right? don't have actual purposes except for mm-hmm, mm-hmm, these right? big swashbucklers coming in town. Yeah.
And sometimes you swing on them and sometimes, you know, they mess you up. It's bananas, right? But yeah. That's the book battle. Mm-hmm. In the movie, it's more like a knife fight in a back alley. Mm-hmm. It's quick and nasty. Mm-hmm. Now, we cut to Dimmy, who responds by shouting, "Shut up!"
Nice comeback, Dimmy.
Yeah. But no, like okay, but Keenan, what do you think he is going on here? Like, I think he has come around. Uh-huh. He knows this is a demon, but just because he's cleared that hurdle doesn't mean he's like properly prepared to deal with a demon. Uh-huh. It's almost like he has to hear Merrin's whole speech all over again because he wasn't really taking it in the first time because like he didn't think it was a demon. And now it's like he can only learn one thing at a time. It's like, wow, a demon. Oh, yeah. What did Merrin say about demons, right? It's like, oh, they, you know, they lie. They mix lies with the truth, right? But yeah, what do we make of this like emotional reaction in the face of the demon?
Oh, yeah. It's getting to him. Mm-hmm. The demon is... has found Dimmy's weak spot. And that's the whole mm-hmm. point, right? As Merrin is saying, like, don't talk to it, don't engage in any of these things, because now the demon knows that that works, right? And yeah. so, yeah, it's not going to happen in this minute, but that's going to escalate, right? You know, is okay, right. That's what's going to bother Damien. He's not over this You know, I'm correct about this, so let's keep digging my little demon hands into that open wound.
Yeah, yeah. But you definitely don't get the sense that, like, Dimmy is like, I am so sick of this delusional girl, and now she's bringing my mother into this. Like, he's mad at Howdy.
Oh, no, he believes it. Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. He, you know, he's mad at whatever he thinks Howdy is, an unclean spirit or the devil himself, right?
Right.
Yeah, he's like, this is Damien out of control.
Yeah. But, like, for that reason, like, half of me wants to cheer because, like, you know, he's yelling at Howdy. You know, they're on a more level playing field than they were, right? When he thought it was all Reagan. It's still a pretty shaky playing field, literally. But he sees Howdy now. And at the same time, he sees that he is no match for Howdy alone.
Can I read to you some lines from the scene in the script? And I don't remember them in the book. You know the book better than I do, obviously. So at this point, oh, right. So, yes, it's a little confusing to try to find the exact corollary for where we are in the script versus in the movie, because in this version of the script, Chris and Sharon come in at one point.
Right. That's been my trouble with trying to insert the book into these minutes, because it's like it's almost like two completely different fights.
Yeah. So at this point, this is a little blurred together. So this is Reagan Demon at first attacking Chris verbally, and then we'll see how it sort of attacks Damien here. So at first, the Reagan Demon says, "See the puke, see the murderous bitch, are you pleased? It is you who has done it. Yes, you, with your career before her, before husband, before anything. The divorce is the cause of her illness. Go to priests, will you? Priests will not help. She is mad. You have driven her to madness and to murder. You have driven her into her grave," right? So attacking Chris, but then I think also then attacking Karis, like, because this is the second half of it is like what Karis has been saying, like, oh no, it's an illness, etc. This is we don't need a priest, we need a doctor, etc. Right. So yeah, the demon is like hitting on all these things that we have been you know, arguing about at the beginning of Act Two in this debate stage about like what we're supposed to do and using it against them here.
Right. Yeah. And actually there's an extra little bit in the book right after that. So Chris is visibly shaken by what Howdy is in Reagan is saying to her at that moment. And Karis urges her to, you know, just get out of the room and you know, so that it doesn't affect her anymore. And so he kind of saves her from having to, cause she was having to like do an injection or something like that. And he's like, it's okay, I'll do it. You get out of here. And don't listen. And so Karis has kind of like come in to save Chris. And so Howdy turns to him and it's like, oh, you're so nice to mothers, Karis.
Yeah, that's here. Yes, we know of your kindness to mothers.
Yeah.
That's mean.
Oh, yeah. And I think what we're going to do, folks, I think we're going to read that part in the next episode because we end on like it's a full minute of Power of Christ Compels You divided from between this minute and the next minute. It's going to be like 30 seconds of this minute and 30 seconds of the next one. So we'll have ample time to catch up with the book in the next episode. But yeah, okay, so we're back with Dimmy. He has just shouted, shut up, to Howdy. And folks, again, at the risk of sounding like we're picking on Dimmy again, like, I would do no better in this situation. Like, I'd probably be doing way worse, right? Howdy'd have all these lines that he'd never end up using because I folded so quick. I'd be a puddle in the corner, and Howdy'd look at Marin and be like, I didn't even start. Like I just asked him how that audition went yesterday. Howdy would actually be mad. He'd like, I did all this research. It is a huge waste of time. Did you know he was actually held back in kindergarten? Marin's like, really? I didn't know that. Oh yeah. There's this time he got lost in a funhouse mirror maze. Like, I wasn't even gonna bring that one up. Frankly, I feel a little sorry for him.
Yeah, Howdy's just like, that's what you're wearing to the exorcism. And go, no.
And let the enemy have no power over her. It's like, hey, how's that novel you're writing?
oh yeah, you've been bringing it up for years in your class, and you always say, oh, so I'm writing a novel, not past tense.
Uh-huh. Boy, it must be a big
must
novel.
Be a lot of pages. Must be so hard to pare it down to manageable size.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure once it does get finished, it's going to be a real page turner. It's going to be, you know. Oh, by the way, I listened to your podcast.
Oh, what did you think of it?
It's, you're getting there. That's what he would do. He wouldn't say it's like, oh, it sucks, right? Because we'd be like, oh, I'm not even gonna listen to that, right? Like he's just being no. He'd be like, I think it was good.
Yeah, keep trying. Yeah,
yeah. Is this? I hope this doesn't sound insulting. Is this your first podcast? How many 5-star? Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that's pretty good. And you've only been doing this for like a couple months. And, oh, a year. Wow. Well, you know, strike and, you know, it's
you know, that's funny. That's my dad. My dad tries to support me. He's very supportive. He's very supportive. You know, but he ends up saying these things in a way he asks how the show is doing or how my screenplays are doing, whatever. I say, oh, this is going on with that. This is going on with this, whatever. And at the end, he invariably says, oh, yeah, well, just don't give up. Like, what I wasn't thinking about. What in my story made you think that I would be thinking that you came up? He's like, oh, no.
You just come with like all these good, it's like, we just got another 5-star review. Right, that's, right. You know, that makes, you know, it's like 50 reviews, and puts his arm around you. And it's like, you know, in times like these, it's important to remember not to lose hope. Right. Well, you know, some people got it. So Dimmy shouts, shut up. Mm-hmm. And at the same time this has been playing out, Marin has been continuing with the exorcism. And it's right here that he says Reagan's full name once again. And once again, the room is hit by a furious jolt, mm-hmm. as if the mention of her name has done something or something is reacting to it. It's so immediate after the mention of the name, I can't look at it any other way than a reaction to the mention of the name. We've made it this far. We've reached the foundation of this infection. It's like we found the infected tooth and we touched it and the whole room is reacting.
Ooh, yeah.
And again, I can't help but wonder, like, who did that? Or did somebody's grip loosen, right? Was the stillness before because both sides were pulling or pushing with equal force, like in a tug of war? You know, like both sides can look like they're standing still, even though there's like this you know, tremendous force involved, mm-hmm. until it's like the pressure building as two tectonic plates are grinding together, and then just like one little slip and that, you know, and all that force is released. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like Reagan's name was the catalyst here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, even in the midst of this shaking, Howdy is still smiting Dimmy with this damning accusation. He says, she'll never forgive you, bastard. And man, I love how Dimmy is reacting. It's even if it's not necessarily what he's supposed to be doing, I love that he's not cowering. I love that he's given it right back to Howdy. And yeah, all he's doing is shouting, shut up, mm-hmm. Over and over again. But even that's better than, you know, a couple minutes ago. Like, he's grown significantly since entering this room to where he is now shouting at the thing from his dream. Mm-hmm. And you get the sense that he doesn't even feel the room shaking. He's so filled with conviction right now.
Right. Yeah, well, that's all very nice for his growth, but Marin, I'm sure, is like, what do I have to do to get you to stop talking to this thing? Like, oh, yeah, I'm glad for you that you're getting over right. your, or whatever you're getting over, but you're going to get us killed.
We don't have time for like, your version of My Fair Lady. By George, I wish you had gotten it before you entered this room. The power of Christ stays mainly on the plane. Yes,
yeah, exactly.
There we go. And as this is going on, we're cutting from Howdy to Karis and back to Howdy and then back again to this medium wide shot where we're on the other side of the bed. The room continues to shake and Dimmy loses his balance and falls, and his copy of the Roman ritual goes flying. Howdy cries bastard one more time at the shadows into which Dimmy has disappeared. Marin has been teetering, but now he falls as well. And finally, Howdy himself falls back onto the bed with a cry of pain as the room finally begins to settle once again. And again, this had me wondering, what just happened? Why did Howdy suddenly cry out and fall back after the priests had already fallen to the floor? And the only thing I can think is that the ritual is working even when the priests aren't talking, which implies that Howdy is feeling its pull this whole time, and in this moment it has proved too much for him.
It's interesting. It's so chaotic as you're watching it. So yeah, you're asking these questions about, yeah, what's causing these individual dramatic beats to happen. For me, as I'm watching it, it just feels like chaos, you know, it's just like
yeah,
anything could happen at any time, which for me is scary.
Yeah. But it's like nothing hit him. Nothing, like there was no holy water. There were no words, mm-hmm. you know, in that moment. So all I can think is that like he's been like feeling something mm-hmm. this whole time. And it was like, you know, now that the priests are down and out, like he can, I don't know, have the luxury of writhing in pain for a minute.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, he's still got these straps right on.
Oh, yeah, the straps.
Yeah, that like, you know, again, it's not going to track logically from shot to shot, but sometimes Reagan is able to sit fully up and you know, accuse right. them in close up, and then in the wide shots, so like, we're aware that there are straps, so she has to sit back down again. Like, there's all right. these forces at work, elastic forces and kinetic forces and yeah, if you're adding now spiritual forces into it, oh, I don't know how to map mm-hmm. this out at all.
Yeah, no, it's impossible.
It's impossible.
Another little fun thing in this shot. So as Karis falls, he's holding on to that that padding at the bottom right bedpost. Mm-hmm. And when he falls, it does this little spin, so it goes all the way around.
That's another famous Exorcist line that's not in the movie.
Hey, there we go. We didn't even think that. You know, it's funny. Right? Yeah,
well, that's in the movie.
That's actually in the movie.
So people wouldn't believe us, I'm sure. Yeah, if we told them that yeah, as uh-huh. the uncle's trying to, as Uncle John, Uncle Tito's just trying to comfort Dimmy, he says, oh, mm-hmm. it's just funny.
Yeah, yeah. Picture this scene, right? A man who's on the verge of losing his faith in God mm-hmm. is going to visit his mother in the psychiatric ward of a dingy, horrible hospital, mm-hmm. and his uncle's with him, and to in order to make his nephew feel better, he says, "You know, it's funny.
You know, one of these days, Dimmy, bam, pow, right to the moon, eh?
Yeah,
yeah. You had to be there."
Yeah. But now we cut and we are on the other side of the bed, and it looks like we're still low to the ground. We're looking down the length of the bed from top to bottom left. So we are with the priests now. We are only on this shot for less than a second, just enough time to see Reagan's yellow blanket ripped from the bed by unseen hands, revealing legs that are purple and bruised with deep lacerations. I can't be sure, but it almost looks as if the blanket goes out the window. Did you catch that?
Oh, yeah, Kenan? Maybe it does, yeah.
Yeah.
That's our poor blanket. We've seen that blanket since the astronaut party, since the...
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that kind of thing makes me sad if we lost this kid's blanket.
Right. And of all the like out that window, that's a very, mm-hmm. You know, that's got a lot of meaning to it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
And we cut to a close-up on Dimmy as he jerks his head to watch the blanket go. It's the same type of cut as when he was like comedically reacting to stuff earlier, but even in this split second shot, we can see in his face that he has grown up since then. Yes, he looks haggard and troubled, but he is no longer stupefied. He is awake to the situation. And even as he jerks his head in that direction, the camera jerks as if to follow, but then Dimmy dismisses it and he turns back to Reagan. More progress. He's recognizing these things as tricks and distractions.
I love how, Friedkin and Roizman, yes, obviously they have a plan of how they're going to shoot the movie. They have this, like, you know, a general tenor and tone that they're setting, like, these rules about, hey, whenever we can, let's move our camera from behind a foreground element or something like that, right? But here in these again chaotic sequences, there's like, well, we're gonna do whatever. We're gonna start moving our camera. It's handheld. It's gonna jerk around. Like, Damien looks to the right. The camera goes to look as if we're gonna follow it, and then like the camera's been psyched out, and we're gonna move back to Damien.
Yes.
Like, yeah, it's like whatever it needs to be here. And then, like, in the next shot, it's an insert shot that is of Reagan's hands, and there's no camera movement at all. You know, it's just like, yeah, whatever we got to do.
Yeah. Now, ever since the cut where the blanket flies off the bed, Marin has been speaking, saying, "I command you." That's how quick these shots were. It took the length of time to say, "I command you." That's where we are. And now we get more of his command. He says, "By the judge of the living," as we cut to a close-up on Reagan's left wrist, bound with those straps. We can see that they're already ragged and yellow. Her arm is whiter than the straps, except for her hand, which is also beginning to turn yellow. Her fingers curled inward so that it resembles a dead spider. But even as we take all this in, the straps begin to pull and fray, and at the word living, they snap. Another cut as Marin continues, and the dead. We have cut to a close-up of Howdy lying back in bed, and at the word dead, Reagan's eyes open, revealing only white. Howdy had her face contorted in pain at the beginning of this shot, but now it has gone slack, as if Reagan or Howdy or both are in some sort of trance. Howdy lets out a ragged sigh, and slowly, as Marin finishes, "To depart from the servant of God." And he finishes, you can hear the tiredness in his voice. Like, it took all of his energy to say, "To depart from the servant of God." And as he says it, Reagan's body begins to rise up off the bed and into the air.
Yeah, this shot of, like, the straps breaking reminds me of, oh, I don't know, like King Kong, or, you know, like it's such an interesting trope, right? Of like a useful trope of, hey, while they're not paying attention, because I don't think we're supposed to see these straps breaking, because they're not really from Karis's point of view. It's more of an objective shot. It's not subjective, right? But hey, audience, what they don't see is that the monster is getting free. King Kong or the velociraptors sort of things, right? Like, they don't see that the velociraptors know how to fucking open doors. Yeah.
Hannibal Lecter has done a little something with the window clip, or whatever. But yeah, no, that's a really good catch, Keenan. I didn't even think, like, because we don't have a shot of Dimmy being like, you know, or anything like that.
Right. Straps. And Carl in the corner going,
"I tried to tell you this whole movie.
Right.
But no one will listen." But yeah, so now, again, I know I probably sound like a broken record here, but of all the supernatural things happening in this scene, this one has me the most confused. Like, I truly do not know what is happening here. Like, who or what is doing this? I have always been confused by this ever since I first saw this. Is this good? Is this bad? Is Howdy doing this? Is the ritual doing this to Howdy? Is he quiet now because he's, like, spellbound? Or is he quiet because he's, like, concentrating on his own spell? Like, what do we think?
Hold on. I think there's some noise in the background. I'm just going to test it.
Okay.
Okay. Usually there's nobody here, but okay. Okay. I think they just walked down.
Oh, the noise hall. On your end.
Yeah, yeah. I think they just walked down the hall past my door, but okay.
Oh, okay.
Is it concentrating zone? What do you think? Yeah, it is. It's interesting. Like, it. Am I just insane? Do you hear anything? Every time I go to look, there's nothing. Okay. Maybe I'm just hearing voices. Sorry, listen.
Maybe I should keep this in because it's proper spooky. It's.
No, but this moment is so interesting because it's weird how, like, this moment of peace can be disconcerting.
Right.
And it's like, no, this should be a fight. We're in the middle of a fight. And you're like, mm-hmm. you're like doing a little dance break, but like a waltz or something, you know, slow and nice and beautiful. Like you're doing the Blue Danube waltz as we're in the middle of our fight. Like, what are you doing here? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know if it's like, if it's good, I don't like it still, you know, like something, it feels like a trick to me. It feels like, oh, maybe I was able to be in this verbal sparring match with Howdy, but now Howdy's not in control of themselves. So that's not good either.
It's like it's like the holy anesthesia has kicked in and Howdy is like comatose now or something that. And you would think it's like, oh, yeah, it's working. Like Howdy is losing his grip because like he looks like he's gone.
Right.
Right. But then what is taking his place? Like, yeah, exactly. that's not Reagan.
Yeah. It's a power vacuum. Yeah. You take out Saddam Hussein, but then what comes after that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Captain Howdy.
Captain Howdy. Yeah. He's from Iraq.
Yeah. Folks, if you have an idea of what this is, please write in and tell us theexorcistminute@gmail.com. Whatever it is terrifying. I think this is one of those shots again. This movie is an embarrassment of riches when it comes to shots that could have been the poster or the cover, even though, you know, the one we have is so iconic. But I mean, like, you can take this shot and slap it on the cover of a book about the movie or have it as the thumbnail to a YouTube video about Pazuzu or horror movies or whatever, right? It's another one of those like every frame of painting shots.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm very thrown off by this noise. Hold on for a second. Okay. You can't hear anything.
Nope.
Okay, give me one
second. What
does
it sound like to you?
Like little kids down the hall laughing, you know, like.
Are you fucking serious?
No, yeah. Hold on. Let me just go look. Let me go look at the little kids. So
I'm keeping all
there.
Of this in.
Hold on. I'll be back.
All right.
I'll be right back.
Jesus Christ. Bye, Kenan. And folks, while Kenan is investigating the sound of children's voices in his supposedly empty office. I just want to take this time to say it has been such a treat working with him, and I am going to miss him very, very much. And nobody tell him that I said any of this, but...
All right, I'm back.
But
All right, it's not little demon children. It's just theater kids. Don't worry.
Oh, okay. There's a slight difference there. Yeah. Okay, all right. Back to this movie. So we cut from here back to the other side of the bed, opposite the priests, and we see how they're seeing this. Marin's reaction is open-mouthed shock. And Dimmy is hunched and clinging to the bedpost. And I'm going to say what I think is going on with them. But first, I just want to say, looking at this shot right now, Kenan, I see Frankenstein's monster, Dr. Frankenstein, and Igor.
Yeah.
Dimmy was what made me think of that, right? Like he's hunched and he's like clinging to the bedpost like a gargoyle. But he's also like right next to Marin, almost like his lackey. And Marin's got, you know, the spectacles and the shock of white hair and he's standing very tall. You know, and both of them are staring at this monster, which is rising on like an invisible slab.
Exactly. Yeah. That's That's very, very true. That's very good. I like that a whole lot. Yeah. It is my job to save us from emails, like it's your job to save us from emails, new mistake, but Igor is not the name of
right. It would be Fritz, right?
Yes. Okay, good. Okay, yes, see, yes. You know, we know,
yes.
I know.
Yes, I know. And I also know that Peter Lorre never played Igor.
No, he never did.
Even though that's like the Igor voice that everybody does, right?
Right. Yes, master. Right.
Yeah.
No, that's not Peter Lorre. Peter Lorre in Casablanca is like, Rick, yes. You've got to save me. Rick, help me. Right. But that's not Igor. Mm-hmm. No.
Right.
That's Dwight Fry as Fritz.
Yes.
Fritz. Who gets killed in the first Frankenstein and then gets brought back as a second character because he's like, this guy's so cool. Let's bring him back. Let's bring this Fritz back. Right. He's so cool.
Yeah. And there's not even an Igor in the book.
No.
Where did Igor even come from then?
There is an Igor in the second or third sequel to Frankenstein that Lugosi plays. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, but he's completely different. His name is Igor, but he's completely different. He's not an assistant like that, and he's more of a villain to it's Son of Frankenstein, I think. So it's beyond Bride of Frankenstein.
I remember being obsessed with this when I was little. I was like, what is the first like instance of a little like that, like you know, like
just little guy,
a little Peter Lorre
right-esque
Igor, because like, yeah, not in the book, not in, you know, the first couple of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And, but like we just associate that with Peter Lorre.
Yeah. But yeah, it's Lugosi, and he's like, I don't think he, well, the name, yeah, is Igor with a Y, it looks like. What the Y? Really?
What? How did this, was it Looney Tunes?
Oh, geez, I don't know.
Like, yeah. were they like caricaturing, because he's always.
Peter Lorre all the time.
Yeah, right? I can see that becoming so popular that people are like, oh, yeah, he must have been Igor somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, okay. Let's get back to The Exorcist, another classic horror film. back to Marin's reaction as he and Demi are staring at Regan floating up off the bed. So from the look on Marin's face, I think it's safe to say that he has never seen this before, even in his previous encounter with Howdy. Or he has seen this and he knows something we don't. He knows exactly what this means. He's either like, thank God we've reached this stage, or oh God, we've reached this stage.
I hear you. I like that he has not seen this before. I think that's a very
So this is a first even for him.
Yeah, yours is interesting. That's really super cool. But then we don't get any indication of that. Like, he doesn't, you know, they have time to decompress later. He doesn't go, that floating, not a good thing.
Right. He would have said, right. Yeah, we almost lost it right there. But then, you know, that 10th power of Christ, that was what.
Exactly.
All right. But no, okay. So, I also like he's. Even having encountered Howdy before, like he's still experiencing things that he has never experienced.
Yeah, he has to go to, well, he doesn't get to, but he has to go to Tom and Bishop Michael later on and say like, well, that floating thing, never seen that before.
Yep.
Yep.
I wouldn't do another exorcism if I were you. You know, they say that Damien has lost his faith. Yeah.
Who says Ma? Oh, they all say around town.
Speaking of Ma's, here his mother is sucking cocks in hell.
Oh, well, she would, wouldn't she?
No. Well, it's none of my business, no. Anyway, did you read that new horror book by that King fella? He's awful good, but he says the word baby too many times. anyway. But yeah, so we both think that Father Marin has never seen this before.
Right.
Dimmy has definitely never seen this. And again, I see two possibilities. He is holding on, both literally and figuratively, holding himself together in the face of this new spectacle. He's not cowering. Mm-hmm. He's past that. But he is using that bedpost to hold himself up and hold himself together. Or this could be the reemergence of little Dimmy, hiding behind that bedpost, even as he stands with his father facing the boogeyman.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah. Now, after what feels like a long moment of shocked silence, almost a reverence for what they are witnessing, Merrin finds his voice to say, "It's the power." And we know what he's gonna say, right? Like, you know it, I know it, we all know this line.
The cleaning power of oranges.
Yeah, exactly. Of Mr. Clean. But no, the way this line is delivered with the pause right there, you could almost read it as, "It's the power, period. It's the power, exclamation point," right? As if he is answering our question. We're like, what is happening? Why is she floating, right? And he's like, "It's the power." And the way he says that, like breathless and awestruck and looking almost ecstatic in that way when like characters in the Bible are witnessing a miracle. Right. Like, look at his face, folks. When he says his first fragment of that famous line, it's like he's saying, "Behold, it's the power."
Mm-hmm.
Now, he doesn't finish that line. Instead, without taking his eyes off Reagan, he motions to Dimmy and he says, "Holy water." And you get the sense that whatever is happening right now, Merrin can't afford to say more than those two words or even turn his head away. Mm-hmm. Whatever is going on requires all of his attention. It really does feel like this is like a critical part of the operation. And maybe now time is like of the essence. Whatever they do next must be done quickly. The surgeon has opened the patient's heart and must work fast. He's like hunched over. He's sweating. He's working between his own heartbeat so his hands don't shake.
Right. And that's been the whole point. That's why Damien is there, is to assist Merrin, and then he's been falling down on the job so far.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Merrin's been saying scalpel, and he's been like, "Oh, my mother." And he's like, no. "Scalpel, what are you
scalpel.
Doing? Right.
My mother used to make scalpels every Sunday. Fried scalpels. Now, before we cut, we see that Merrin's face has been eclipsed by Reagan's form. Mm-hmm. And out from under it, we see Dimmy's face again. It had been swallowed up as she was rising. Now we cut, and once again, the bottom of Reagan's nightgown floats up, revealing a close-up on Dimmy. It's like the rise of a curtain. But just as Dimmy tears his eyes away from Reagan, perhaps to look for the holy water that Merrin mentioned, the room is hit with another jolt. And at first, it appears to knock him down again until you see that no, he is running to the other side of the bed. Perhaps that jolt was meant to keep him from getting to the holy water, but we can see from another cut, we're at the bottom left corner of the bed as Dimmy rounds that corner, clinging to the bedpost and using it to swing around to the other side of the bed. He grabs the holy water and hurries back once again, using that bedpost to help him make that sharp turn. He reaches Merrin, who has fallen but is already back up by the time Dimmy reaches him. Not only that, he has begun to say, "It is the power of Christ that compels you." And as he is saying this, we have cut again back to an overhead of Reagan / Howdy floating up in a shot I have seen on posters and book covers and in thumbnails. This one is even more recognizable than the one we just had. And it's one of those pictures that you can hear. You can hear Merrin saying in his tired but like awed and breathless voice, "It's the power of Christ that compels you." And of course, she is in that Christ-like pose with her arms outspread. Another absolutely iconic shot.
Mm-hmm. You know, if there's going to be earthquakes in the Washington, D.C. area, probably the best place to be is here in the air, right? So she's floating up and there's earthquakes and she doesn't feel any of these earthquakes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. These mortals down there on the floor have to squish around or whatever.
That's the, you know, they had like a, you know, duck and cover, you know, in schools and everything like that. Right. So they have those little grainy black and white videos. Mm-hmm. It's like, now Reagan here knows what to do.
I love Duck and Cover. Have you seen that recently? Or
I have not. I've only seen parodies of it.
Oh my goodness. Well, I think it's become such a classic because it is so much of a self-parody. Mm-hmm. So you could watch Duck and Cover and it is so square, right? Because it's from the 50s and then it's for kids. So they are like saying, like, you know, they say things like, if you aren't sure what to do in the case of a nuclear blast, talk to an adult. Adults will help us, as they always do. It's like, oh, geez. Yeah. And he crouches down and covers his face because glass could be flying and cut him. And it's like, oh, geez. Yeah. No, it's very good. It's a very interesting, fun video. Yeah, it works both on its face value. And then it also is just this weird, like, you know, all these kids are going to die if this happens. But they're like, oh, cover yourself with newspaper. If you're out in a picnic and you're reading the newspaper, just cover your face with newspaper. That'll help. It's better than not covering your face in newspaper.
Right.
Except you're going to get, you know, Marmaduke comics burned into your face for the rest of your life. But, you know, oh, geez.
You'll get a really nifty tattoo out of it.
Yeah, but this, I think, yeah, we liked this this BFI Exorcist monogram by Mark Kermode, and that has this was a cover that you and I were looking at early on in this, and this is a little girl. It's not quite Reagan, right? Because they have to use their own art, but yeah, upside down in this cross format, floating in the air, and then we have hands from presumably Karis or Marin like reaching out to her. Just a wonderful, wonderful shot. Can we do kind of a speed round about ways in which the Reagan McNeil story is an inversion of the Christ story?
Sure, yeah. We haven't explored that yet.
So Reagan McNeil's father is not in the picture, and she seems to be born from a single mother, right?
Oh, I didn't even know we were doing this today. This is great.
So that's one. What else do you have? She floats up here in this in this parody of the crucifixion.
Which I never gave any thought to this. So
no, these are things that I think you're thinking.
Blowing my mind.
Well, I guess if we sort of Reagan is like the Christ child, not in her permanent house, right? She's sort of born into this world in a place where they are travelers and they don't have their house of their own.
That is true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Reagan is, let's see, does Reagan teach in the temple like Jesus does?
Oh, kind of like, could we compare that to like, precociousness, kind of like speaking above one's age.
Yeah, I would say so. So like when she
like
talks
being a little
to,
bit too grown up, being a
yeah,
little
when
grown
she talks
up too
to
fast.
Dr. Klein and tells him right not to, to keep her or his fingers away from her goddamn cunt. Like, oh, look how precocious she is. Yeah. She's visited by
I mean she's literally talking to priests and making like jokes about scripture,
right? Yeah, absolutely.
So you know that's maybe a closer. Yeah.
She will of course she will of course anti-Lazarus Burke.
Oh, there you go. Sure. I have never heard it referred to as anti-Lazarus.
Anti-Lazarus, anybody.
You know how it's like in social media, like you can't say kill, so you just say unalive,
yeah,
right now?
Yeah, it's so weird. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But now, you know, it's the gen beta. They're going to be saying, they're going to say anti-Lazarus.
Anti-Lazarus, somebody. Right. Right, but then, the function of the Christ is to die and... for sacrifice themselves and to die for your sins. And
right.
Reagan does a version of that, you know, which we'll get to. She is sort of destroyed, and then she brings back the good news to at least to Dyer. I don't know about everybody else. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else? What else happens in Christ's story that we might be able to find here?
I'm trying to think. Like the 40 days being tempted in the desert, but that's
if we don't have them, maybe some of our listeners can think of some too.
Yeah.
Being put on trial by the Romans. I'm not sure if we have any of that.
Oh, but I mean, like, she's got doctors and she's got priests all kind of like arguing over her.
Right.
Yeah.
She does not cure lepers and make blind men see and lame men walk.
No.
Maybe there's a version of that there. And then, of course, you know, the big inversion is the Legion story, right?
Right.
So yes. In that story, Christ pushes Legion out from an ill man into a herd of pigs. And in this story, she's going to be defeated by Damien, you know, using the power of Legion against her, I suppose.
Right. Or the power of the Legion story.
Yes, the power of the Legion story against her, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Hmm. But yeah, just keep an eye out for those types of things, because, yeah, I think there's a lot there that maybe we're not even paying attention to yet.
Interesting. Yeah, I was clocking it with, like, some of the imagery. Cause,
yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Know, like, you know, but with the arms outstretched. But yeah, I didn't think to go any deeper than that.
But absolutely,
yeah,
no. But the imagery is where I'm thinking about it, right? That's why I'm thinking of it. And, like, you know, this scarring of the body, these things that look like lashes against her, right? It's as if she's being whipped, but she's, you know, but it is from holy water or from, you know, God's love or whatever it is, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, and it doesn't really say this in the book or the movie, but if we were really, really stretching, we could almost say that she's doing this, you know, and punishing herself to kind of like fix Chris and Howard's, you know, relationship.
Absolutely.
And she's like, I'll take all of the sins upon me, and, you know, I'll let Captain Howdy do this to me if it means that Mom and Dad will get back together.
That's absolutely happening. No. I think that's absolutely, like, she's going to, you know, cure or at least bring them to a point where they can move on from their relationship. I don't think that's a stretch at all. And she's going to bring back, you know, she's going to bring back the elixir, as Joseph Campbell might say, or she's going to bring the good news, as the Christ would say, right? To our characters who survive. Absolutely.
Okay. And then in that way, like, killing Burke would be like part of that, would be like, got to get rid of him first, because, you know, to her, like, he's the, you know, he's the big bad. He's like the thing in the way.
Yeah, I like that. Mm. But yeah, I'm springing this on Lester, and we're seeing, but if anyone has any ideas, right, I think it's an interesting question to ask. We're not saying that we have all the answers or the enough to put into our term paper yet, but as a group, we could put that into our collective term paper.
Yes, and if you guys help us with that, we will absolutely give you partial credit on that term paper.
That's right.
Yeah. But yeah, so we cut to a close-up of Dimmy, but we hear Marin begin to say, "The power of Christ compels you." It's the first time that this is uttered, right? Mm-hmm. Because the one before was a little bit different. It was, "It's the power of Christ that compels you," right? Mm-hmm. Now it's, "The power of Christ compels you." At first, Dimmy is like mouthing the words along with him, but on the word Christ, he adds his own voice to the prayer. And as if in reaction to this, to the word Christ or to Dimmy joining, the room is hit with another jolt. But neither of the priests fall this time. Mm-hmm. We cut again. We are once again on the other side of that bed opposite the priests, but the bed is gone. It has sunk below the edge of the screen, below the rim of the world, as Blatty puts it. Reagan has stopped rising and floats fixed in the air, almost touching her shadow, which looms over all of them on the ceiling. Her legs are stiff and her toes are pointed, but her arms hang limply down behind her, even while still in that cross position. Below her, the priests continue chanting, "The power of Christ compels you." And again, "The power of Christ compels you." Each time, Marin flings holy water in her direction. After the second time, we cut to a close-up of Reagan's feet as the holy water lands on her calf and creates what looks like a jagged, bloody line, like a cut or a burn. Is that how you read it, Keenan? That this was the holy water? It's not just like Reagan's skin splitting?
No, I think that, the holy water is lashing her,
Okay.
And the makeup effect is so good because Dick Smith has been smart that, like, you know, there has to be this sort of discolored spot that's going to get removed as the makeup is stripped off, but but he has other parts of her leg similarly discolored, so we don't see like this particular one that we're looking at is the action one, the other ones are just like it.
Hide it in plain sight.
Very clever.
Okay, so from here we cut and we are now back in that room, left corner of the bed, shooting into that corner. I'm realizing now this bed is a good compass for me to see where we are and where we have been. I think we have shot from almost all the regular points, right? East, west, north, south. Mm-hmm. This bed is such a perfect situator of the room, I think.
Yeah, I wasn't tracking which directions, but yeah, I agree with you. No, we've shot in every single corner of this room. We're going to spend so much time here that, you know, Friedkin and with him Roizman, right, is like trying to figure out like how are we going to make it from feeling stale. Like it never feels like we're repeating things, right?
Right.
Yeah. And they built this set and they've made it, you know, large enough and manageable enough that we can go and shoot into all these different spots as opposed to, you know, that's why we have to shoot it here as opposed to just finding a bedroom. Right. Because they're like, oh, if you were to shoot in your bedroom or my bedroom or Billy Friedkin's bedroom, might we run out of spaces to be in?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But yeah, we're shooting from that bottom left corner as the priests finish another intonation of "The power of Christ compels you." Mm-hmm. There's a pause in between each of these next three intonations. It's very short, but you get the sense that they are waiting for something to happen. Right? This is no longer rote. Mm-hmm. This isn't like a thing where they have to say it a certain number of times. Mm-hmm. This isn't in the Roman ritual. The prayer has jumped from the page and into real-time application, right? This is an active part of the exorcism, which is being repeated until they get the desired result. And especially now, you can see it in their faces, in their stance. They say the command, pause, and then say it again. They're trying to make something happen or waiting for God to make something happen.
And it's kind of like, you know, Marin is sort of leading it, or like Damien is like waiting for Marin to say like, no, again, like we're going to do this again.
No, you're exactly right. Yeah. Dimmy is following Marin's lead. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know what's supposed to happen. I think Marin is trying to get something to happen. It's not happening. So he keeps on trying it again. And Mary's just, and Dimmy's just following that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, which actually, that's a little scary because does that mean they had to stop the exorcism to do this thing?
Because this is not in the ritual.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Roman ritual, capital R, Roman ritual, right?
Right.
That was my question because the script here never says the power of Christ compels you.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what it would say in the book, but that makes sense since the ritual doesn't say that. So the script has them... which we'll hear, right? The mystery of the cross commands you, the faith of the saints and the martyrs commands you, the blood of Christ commands you, the prayers of, and they get cut off, the blood of Christ commands you, the blood of Christ commands you. Mm-hmm. So we never hear the power of Christ compels you in the script, in this version of the script.
Interesting. And I was looking back, like, you know, in trying to figure out a place where to put our book reading, I was like, okay, this will be the the magnetic north that I can I can stick to. But yeah, I couldn't find it there either.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? So it's I don't know. So I don't know what happens. I couldn't find it. Like, if that is it wouldn't make sense that the technical advisors would say no. What they should say is the power of Christ compels you, because that's not in the ritual,
right?
And then it is, you know, improvs happen. I think a lot of times how improv works on movies is misunderstood, because there are improvs that are like, say, within one shot, and right. it just sort of happened. It's an ad lib, or somebody slips, or someone says the wrong line, or mm-hmm. or what have you. But this is, if this is an improv, this is, it's something that they all decided that they were going to keep doing across multiple pieces of coverage.
Right.
Which still have, that's still, that could still be an improv, but it's not yeah. like, you know, it's not a mistake or a slip or something that we've just discovered during this take. They could have discovered it in rehearsals or in a certain take, and then Friedkin and the actors were like, let's keep doing that.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if it, like, if it happened because, like, the mechanism wasn't lowering her fast enough, maybe?
And they're sort of, yeah, I guess so, because that, it is across these two, at least these two or three different shots that are doing it, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. But yeah, I need to look into that. I couldn't find a reason why that's changed, and then, yeah, as you say, becomes mm-hmm. the most famous line from the movie.
That's so weird. It, like, it is the most famous line, and it is not, like you say, it is not in the screenplay. Mm-hmm. It is... as far as I remember, it's not in the book, mm-hmm. and it's not part of the Roman ritual,
right.
and it is the one line that everybody remembers.
Right. So it's that not so it's weird. Not the technical advisor's father, Nicola, saying, no, you should say this, because right. where is that? That's not anywhere, or Birmingham saying that.
Yeah, it's just like,
And you counted, they say it 8 times, right?
I believe so.
so oh, it's God, not a mistake. To... I mean, it's not an accident. I mean, it's not a slip of the tongue. Oh, I meant to say the blood of Christ commands you. And I said,
right.
the power of Christ compels you 8 times, at least, yeah, you know, in the cut of the movie. And that probably means mm-hmm. they said it, you know, 40, 50 times as you're shooting
right,
it.
Right. Yeah. But no, they say it a bunch of times in this minute. Like this, mm-hmm. this is, it's like a solid minute of right. them saying this. Mm-hmm. And it just happens to be cut between this minute that we're talking about this week, and then next minute is going to be like the right. first 30 seconds of that.
Yeah. So why did they say that? Let us know.
Yeah.
Folks at home.
And why? Okay. So why did the actors say it? Mm-hmm. But then also, like, what in the story? Again, like, I hope I'm using like diegetically right.
Mm-hmm, right.
But like what compelled the priests?
Right.
In the story to say what possessed the priests in the story to say this, like did something like, it's like, oh, you know, it's not worth, like they brought out the defibrillator.
Right.
That's what this is, right? Mm-hmm. This is like, oh no, it's going south, boys. Let's the power of Christ.
It's going south, baby.
Yeah. It's going southwest. Like the airline? No, the wind. But no, like that's what fascinates me is why did they stop the exorcism to do this thing?
Right.
Right? Like, is the reason that they're doing it is because like Reagan is edging closer to the brink and they gotta like get her back to a safe place before they can continue the exorcism proper?
Hmm.
Like, I wish I could find a better metaphor, but like it's like they're cops arresting Howdy and they're reading him his rights, and then he suddenly grabs a hostage mm-hmm. and they have to immediately like change tack and like talk him back down.
Mm-hmm.
And none of this is part of the routine. This is like actively trying to get back to a place of safety almost.
Yeah. Or maybe she's floating up there and they're like, well, geez, I don't know what to say to that. Yeah. Right, the power of Christ.
What does the book say about this?
It's not in the book. Right. Yeah. So it in that reading, it's like compulsive, right? It's not like, I don't know if this is working or not. It's just like,
right,
we gotta do something, right? Like mm-hmm. in The Aviator, he just says, you know, because that's Howard Hughes, and he has
right.
he has severe mental illness, right? Mm-hmm. But he gets stuck. He says, "Show me all the blueprints. Show me all the blueprints. Show me all the blueprints. And he says that for like, what, 10 minutes of that movie?
Right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So this feels a little bit like I am so discombobulated by seeing this little girl rise up in the air and stop. She's not yelling at us right now. She's not trying to hurt us right now. This is so weird.
Yeah.
What even is this?
Right. It's even more disturbing than Howdy actively fighting them.
Right. Yes.
Because you don't know, like, could this be like a buildup to something?
It could be anything, yeah.
Like you know how you see kids, like a kid gets hurt, and you see that eye of the storm where mm-hmm. they're like sucking in breath before they start to cry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh man. And the longer it takes, you're like, oh my God, this is gonna be bad. This is gonna be really bad, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. It, or like, yeah, it just like, why, why the stillness? Mm-hmm. Like the more still something is, the more uneasy I feel.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and we can see that Marin is looking for something to happen. He's hoping to get a response of some sort. Mm-hmm. But like, what do we make of Dimmy's face here? Because I don't know if he knows what's going on right now.
Right.
Like we said, like, I think he's just following Marin's lead, right? Not only is this his first exorcism, but like I said, this is not even part of the ritual. So even if he like stayed up all night the night before and studied what's supposed to happen,
right,
like this is completely surprising him as well.
Yeah, as a semi-difficult actor, that was something I would have trouble with. I mean, that's not the kind of conversations that Billy Friedkin might like, but I'm like, why, if I'm playing Karis, why am I going along with him saying this stuff? Where is this coming from? Why are we saying this, right?
And Friedkin would say, Keenan, I don't give a flying fuck through a rolling donut.
You do the prep. No, but I think he actually was keen to answer those types of questions because he would. But yeah, but you know, but he, you know, I don't know. Maybe he would have also been like, I would say, I'm not sure about this, Billy. I have all these questions about this. I've done all the research, the Roman ritual, and it's not in there. And so maybe I'm doing this because I'm so in awe. Maybe I'm doing this to humor him because I think he's gone off script, but I don't want him to get his A game off, right? Like, what do you think? Mm-hmm. And Billy just turns to the stunt man who has the harness connected to my back and says, pull fucking hard. I want you to really yank this guy off his fucking feet.
Knock a couple of his teeth out so he can't ask these stupid questions anymore.
No, but I think Friedkin was okay with that. But like his these kind of actorly questions, I haven't heard anybody say that he didn't like those kind of questions or anything like that.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, one of his, we talked about his one of his influences, of course, is like Hitchcock, and like everyone of his generation loved Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. And Hitchcock was notorious for saying those types of really bitchy things back, and people would, you know, he would repeat them. He was like, "Oh, let me tell you this funny story about how terrible I was to an actor," you know. Mm-hmm. And we're like, you know, Alfred, I don't understand why I'm going in there. Like, I know the birds are in there. I could hear. I've just been attacked by birds. I hear flapping in the middle of the night. Why would I leave the safety of the downstairs and go up by myself and open this door? And Hitchcock would say, because I tell you to.
There we go, folks. It's a generational.
Yeah, you know, And some actors like that kind of thing, and some actors don't like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But he would say, you know, they would, I forget who was interviewing him, but someone was like, you know, Mr. Hitchcock, you once said that actors are like cattle. And he says, oh, no, I would never say that. Oh, no, really? He was like, no, I would never say that. I said, actors should be treated like cattle.
Oh, Hitch.
Oh, Uncle Freddy.
Yeah. Uncle Billy and Uncle Freddy are just up there yucking it up now.
That's right.
Watching each other's movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Watching other people's movies and just shitting all over them.
Yeah. Watching Jordan Peele and Ari Aster and being like, oh, these fucks.
Fuck do they think they are? Anyway, actually, Keenan, so for Karis following Marin through this improvised bit right here, I also wonder if perhaps in becoming real for him, it has also become personal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even though his mother has not made an appearance yet in this room, he might be thinking of her as he shouts these commands at Captain Howdy. He might be thinking of the years that he spent in hell struggling with his faith, right? He has put a name to the face in his dreams, and he is like standing up to the boogeyman now. Like he's thinking of like if you are the devil, then fuck you. like thinking about like all of the, you know, the shit that he has gone through, like wondering if there's a God, wondering if he's worthy. And now he has proof. And he's like, oh, fuck you.
I don't give a flying fuck if my mother sucks rolling donuts in hell.
Because the power of Christ compels you. You stupid Captain Howdy fuck. Okay, our minute concludes with the eighth. There we go. I did write it down. Eight times, yes.
Eighth so far, and then it keeps
eight
going.
Eight so far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
right. Yeah. With the eighth utterance of that famous line. Mm-hmm. What a way to end a minute, folks. But we are nowhere near done. We'll pick back up with this final battle next week, but for now, that is all of my notes. Keenan, is there anything else?
No, I think we got it, baby.
All right. Now you're just going to... Oh, boy. Folks, this has been another excellent Exorcist Minute. I've been Lester Ryan Clark. You can reach me on all the socials as Lester Ryan Clark.
And I've been Keenan Diaz. You can find me on Instagram and Letterboxd at Howdy Keenan.
Yeah, we got our Facebook listener group, Compelling Conversations. Go check that out and request to join, and we'll let you in here with us. Thank you so much to everyone who has shared the show by word of mouth or on social media. And a big thank you to everyone who has given us a 5-star ratings on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen to our show. We really appreciate that. It's going to help our little podcast grow and find more cool people like you. Okay, Keenan. Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I think I am, Lester.
Folks, until next time, the power of duck and cover compels you. Remember, kids, when the end of days arrives, and lions are giving birth in the streets,
horses eating each other,
and the rivers run with blood, and the great red dragon comes, just duck and cover. Do what Reagan does and get up in the air.
That's right. And remember, kids, when the Lamb has opened the seventh seal, there will be silence in heaven about the space of half an hour, and you'll know what to do. Duck and cover. That's right. Duck and cover. Whoa, to the inhabitants of the earth. But to ye I say, duck and cover.
And remember, kids, when you look and you behold a pale horse, and his name that sat on him is death, and hell follows with him, and the power given unto him, the power of the fourth part of the earth, to kill with sword and with hunger and with death, and with the beasts of the earth, such as ducks. And remember, kids, when you stand upon the sand of the sea and you see the beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy, duck and cover.